Good afternoon and welcome to the Community Action League. The Community Action League is a collaborative effort of local organizations and nonprofits. Our goal is to raise awareness that impact people here in Gallatin County and discuss the organizations that listeners can engage with that are relevant to those topics. On our show, we discuss the intersectionality or connections between topics at the local, national, and global levels. We encourage cooperation in community organization, information sharing, and create a connected service network to best serve and educate individuals in our community and beyond. Tune in to learn more about topics like consent, housing, transportation, human rights, addiction, and more. And today we're going to talk about healthcare, specifically for those of you that identify as part of the LGBTQ+ community. We'll discuss some of the challenges this community faces accessing healthcare, what health disparities they face, and how to overcome some of these challenges in order to ensure that we can all remain healthy and well. So my name is Cami. I do outreach and education for Bridger Care. And it's important to me to make sure that all people, whether they belong to any groups that are minorities because of race, religion, sexual orientation, any of those groups have all the same access to healthcare. And for us, the focus is on sexual healthcare, of course, because that's what we do. But we recognize, too, that people need to access healthcare in other places. So we wanted to help ensure that there was training throughout the Gallatin Valley and beyond for healthcare providers for how to be allies within the healthcare community. So we have worked to develop a training for healthcare providers, and we didn't want to do it alone because obviously there are a lot of amazing people out there who have great information. So we've been joined by other organizations such as Diversity and Inclusion Student Commons. We've worked with members and allies of the LGBTQ community. We've worked with folks who work in the medical community to kind of create this training and do that sort of thing. And today I'm lucky enough to be joined by a couple of people that are helping to provide this training. And the first person I'll introduce is Sonia Benton. Sonia, do you want to tell us who you are and how you became involved in making sure people receive affirming healthcare?
Yeah, so my name's Sonia. So I'm adjunct faculty, oh my goodness, at Montana State University, but in my free time, my other job is working with every nonprofit that will let me work with them, which is most, thankfully. My main role currently is I do a lot of work with the Safe Zone training on MSU's campus that runs through the Diversity and Inclusion Student Commons, as well as with Sustained Dialogue, which is a conflict de-escalation group, and a whole bunch of other wonderful organizations in town and in Montana as a whole. That's roughly who I am and why I'm invited here. Why I think this matters is because I'm a part of the LGBTQ+ community, and as someone with a chronic illness, it's often very difficult for people with illnesses to get care at all, and for me it's very difficult to find providers that are affirming and helpful to my identity and that understand that I don't need a pregnancy test every 3 days. That can give me really good health care, but that also don't make me feel unwelcome while I'm getting that health care. So for me, this is very personally relevant. It affects me, it affects my spouse, it affects my friends, it affects a lot of the people that I know and care about. So why on earth wouldn't I care too?
Absolutely, and we were very happy to be joined by Sonia, in part because this isn't the first inclusion training that you've done for LGBTQ communities. You focus on more than just health care as well. Yes. Outside, do you not?
Yes, so I focus more on inclusivity as like a whole rather than healthcare specifically because I don't have a ton of, you know, healthcare experience. I've been a patient before, but that's about it.
Totally fair. And we're also joined by Christopher Coburn, who works in public health here in Bozeman. And Christopher joined and helped us actually put the training together and helps lead it. Christopher, do you want to tell us who you are and why you do what you do?
Yeah, so I'm Christopher, and I work in public and community health throughout Southwest Montana. And I got involved in this training just basically out of interest, need, and I think excitement. I have worked for a while now working with LGBTQ plus populations and around healthcare, particularly service and just understanding the healthcare systems. In previous roles that I've had for Planned Parenthood of Montana, I helped create an LGBTQ-specific and inclusive sex ed curricula to kind of address some of the healthcare disparities around sexual health that are not new, but we are learning to understand in a deeper and more meaningful way. And I also just do a lot of work, kind of like Sonia, in my quote-unquote free time, working with nonprofits to build more inclusive communities. The way, main way that happens is I'm the board president for a nonprofit that's based in Missoula, but throughout Montana. It's called Empower Montana. And we work with folks to build more just and inclusive communities in whatever that might mean to that specific community, tackling issues from racism to homophobia to cultural appropriation and all the ways that those things intersect in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you mentioned some of the healthcare disparities that exist and trying to create sex ed curriculum that helps young youth and adults understand kind of what some of those challenges are. Do you want to talk about some of what the disparities are among the LGBTQ population and what a disparity is?
Yeah, so the way that I kind of think about a disparity is an issue or problem that impacts certain populations at disproportionate rates. So people who are no different from other folks, aside from a couple indicators that say, experience that burden or that problem at higher levels than their peers who don't have those same identities. So an example in the sexual health world that I think that I find surprising is when I was working a lot with high school students, we were doing a lot of research, and what we were finding is that young bisexual female identified folks experience unintended pregnancy at much higher rates than their heterosexual classmates. And there are a couple of reasons for that, and a lot of reasons for that probably, but the main one that I came to realize and that I may be most passionate about is just the lacking education for folks with those identities in their sexual health classes. Other disparities that exist, obviously, one that people maybe are more familiar with is just the rates of HIV in young gay males. And that's a huge disparity, that there's no reason that HIV is more, it doesn't have an affinity for LGBTQ folks. There just is something going on in terms of disparities to access education and resources that is allowing HIV to be endemic in some of those populations. And there's a lot more. You know, we're talking about people who are bullied at higher rates in school settings because either they are or they're perceived to be LGBTQ plus, people who are completing suicide throughout the nation in Montana, higher rates, people who, again, are either perceived to be or indeed identify with being LGBTQ plus. So there's a whole host of them that are related to the education school setting, and they're all kind of linked to, I think, you know, I was working primarily in sexual health, mm-hmm. but they're all connected.
Mm-hmm. And Sonia, were there any of the healthcare disparities or just disparities in general that you feel like are especially important for people to recognize as they go about their daily lives that may affect this community more than others?
So I guess kind of to start, like this population tends to be a little bit bigger than people expect in Montana. Mm-hmm. Like the LGBTQ plus population hovers somewhere between 8% and 10% depending on who's doing the survey. So that's kind of the rough estimate, which is about the same as the American population as a whole. So Montana's not, like, less gay than anywhere else.
We may have fewer people, so there are fewer numbers, but the same percentages. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I hear that a lot. Like, there just aren't people like that here. We're here.
Yeah.
Right here, yeah. Many of us. But I think a lot of the disparities are more in, like, the way that healthcare is handled and, like, how people come to feel about healthcare in this community. Because I know a lot of the college students that I work with really struggle with wanting to go to the doctor or get help for their mental health or their physical health or any other sense of health, no matter what it is, because they're afraid that they won't be taken seriously and that they won't be understood or cared about by their providers in the same way that their friends who identify as straight or cisgender may feel.
Mm-hmm.
Cisgender, for those of you that don't know, are people that have the same gender identity as what they were assigned at birth. So if you were born a girl and you identify as a woman, you're cisgender.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's where the disparities tend to, you know, crop up, is more in, like, the emotional difficulty of access rather than, like, an intentional problem a lot of the time.
Well, and I think a big chunk of it is, too, before we created this Healthcare Allies training, one of our old staff members who was at the university at the time studying to get her master's in public health degree, she did a survey called that she entitled Rainbow in the Rockies, and she designed it to measure the knowledge, confidence, and interest in transgender healthcare. And so she talked to 67 medical healthcare professionals here in Montana, and 48% of those healthcare providers said they had never received any education or information about LGBTQ plus health issues at all. 53% did not feel confident in their ability to treat sexual and reproductive health issues, specifically in trans patients, and 87% said they wanted to learn more about trans healthcare specifically. And on the transgender side of things, we do know that 1 in 5 transgender folks have been denied healthcare by a physician, which are numbers that are not great. And part of that could be, you know, the bias that the healthcare provider doesn't want to see that person. But part of it can also just be they don't necessarily know how to help them, and they're not willing to try, and they just don't even know where to start. And so that might be part of what the problem is. And that's part of why we felt it was important to educate healthcare providers in our area, so that they would be more of a welcoming environment. And it's a long, ongoing process, because especially if anybody has ever had a bad experience going to the doctor and disclosing their sexual orientation or gender, they may not want to go back to a doctor again. And you can't necessarily blame them if somebody, you know, if they come away from it feeling void as a person, why would they want to put themselves through that again, especially if they weren't able to address the specific health issue that they were there to see their provider about. So it's definitely an ongoing issue with training and helping folks understand their specific health needs, and it's an emerging science, I feel like. It's only been just the last few years that the healthcare community has even looked at these, what these disparities might be, and tried to measure them to figure out some of the reasons why. Because I think, as has been pointed out, a lot of the reason why there are these disparities may have to do with some of this internalized oppression. Is that what you were talking about, Christopher?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of the issue. I think, you know, if you're thinking about the cycle of oppression and how oppression like permeates through culture, really a key part of that is internalizing messages you hear and see and feel about yourself, and that in turn leads to misinformation being perpetuated, and that misinformation turns into mistreatment, and once mistreatment becomes part of our institutions, it becomes institutionalized and systemic, which makes it harder to break down, which is how you see a healthcare system that has been able to really ignore a big part of the population for a long time. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, I think that there is this really strong piece of internalization that is crucial to break down. And I do think that it's, you know, it's what we call it, a cycle, because one of the ways that you can break down some of those internal messages that people might think about themselves is by providing them support and affirmation at places where other people get support and affirmation, which healthcare is one of those places, mm-hmm. And one of our big institutions. Other places, education, housing, these places that, you know, we think of that still have a lot of work to do, but have maybe been thinking about it a little bit sooner than the medical community.
Mm-hmm. And I like what you say about still having work to do. I think it's one of those things that folks are might be trying to get more training on, but it's not something you learn overnight, right? It's not a factor of statistic. Every individual person is unique, and it's just learning about how to interact with people in a standardized way, especially in healthcare, so that it isn't one of those things, you know, you're asking everybody the same questions, so you're not making assumptions, and just making sure that their needs are met. So if you don't know about the difference between gender, sex assigned at birth, and sexual orientation, maybe we should break that down. Does one of you want to tackle one of those?
I can start. Oh gosh, what were the terms we were about to define?
Gender, sex assigned at birth, or sexual orientation, and how they're different or interrelated or not.
Awesome. So I'll actually start with sex assigned at birth. So that's the sex that is on your birth certificate. Pretty simply, that's what it is. For my partner, for example, it might be male. For me, it's female, but it's a little bit more complex because I was actually born intersex, which is the third option, which is included in our LGBTQ+ acronym. But it's the people that morphologically, hormonally, or physically don't adhere to what we typically think of as male or female, based on, you know, their chromosomes, their hormones, their external genitalia, their internal organs, all of this. So very medical, clear cut.
Mm-hmm.
So that's your sex assigned at birth. So you have those three options, so to speak. Gender is how you choose to identify yourself. So for me, I choose to identify myself as genderqueer, meaning that I don't really feel a particular need to assign a specific word to myself. I don't really think it's incredibly useful. And I just mostly avoid it, to be completely honest. I got really bored of labels and just gave up at some point. And that's my personal thing. That's how I personally choose to identify. My partner, whose sex assigned at birth is male, also chooses to identify as gender fluid or gender queer, which means that they don't assign a line together, right?
Okay.
Which would put them into the transgender community, which means a whole bunch of different things to a whole bunch of different people. There are thousands and thousands of combinations, but effectively gender is who your inner sense of yourself. So it's personally identified. It is the identity that you choose because it is who you are. Your sex or sex assigned at birth is entirely based on what your body is. And these things don't always match perfectly, which I think is pretty understandable to people when it's explained that way, but it's also something that we don't really know what causes it or why. It's just humans.
Absolutely. And it sounds like when you're talking about gender, I think a lot of people, especially when we look at little kids, think about boys and girls. Mm-hmm. But if you want to explain a little bit more that it's not necessarily just those two categories?
No. So there's a whole bunch of different words people use for gender. So there's gender nonconforming, which means that they choose not to conform to any specific gender, right? Because we have a whole bunch of cultural gender roles that can feel kind of uncomfortable and not true to who we are. You can identify as transgender. You can identify, you know, as a variety of different words. There's a few hundred probably. But most of them are somewhere in the middle, right? So you have male and you have female and you have, you know, I don't want to be a part of that binary at all. And then you have people that are somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. And then you have people that land on one side or the other. Mm-hmm. And the words that they choose to describe themselves are really just the words that they find most personally affirming. It's kind of like how I get to choose what my nickname is in class.
Mm-hmm.
I choose Sonia because I'm boring. But if my name was Nicholas, I might choose Nick.
Mm-hmm. Or Nikki.
Yeah. Or Nikki. Or a variety of Nico. Yeah. These are all different options. And so I think the words, specific definitions tend to matter a little bit less because it's pretty personal. I think the thing that tends to come out the most and the thing that you hear the most about is somebody that's not a part of the LGBTQ+ community or not a part of the people doing inclusivity training are the pronouns that people use. So there's she, he, they, and Z and Z. Z is spelled with an X one way and a Z the other way. They sound the same. And so there's a variety of different pronouns that people might feel comfortable with. I use they because I like the gender neutral term. It's already valid in English. I'm an English teacher. I promise it's really a valid usage for the word. But also it's the word that I feel is most affirming and that I like the best. It's easy, it's already part of English, it's not hard for me to say, I struggle with Z sounds. So it's what I choose for myself in the same way that I choose my name and my gender identity to a certain extent. Mm. Like, these things are innate, but they're also something that I get to pick what I call them.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one thing that's I like to think about sometimes too is when we're talking about gender and gender identity, it's really this, like, internal consistent, insistent and persistent sense of who you are and how you exist in the world. And so it's nice because we have these things that we can choose, like the pronouns, the way that we want to identify that, but it's not really a choice in the sense that it's this internal consistent and persistent drive of understanding who you are. And for many people, I would say most people, that sense of gender identity is in alignment with the sex assigned at birth, so it's not something that has to be thought about or really pondered, because it fits into this binary that our society and many societies have kind of adopted as what the truth is, right, or what the only way of thinking is. But for folks whose you know, consistent and persistent sense of identity isn't in alignment with either the sex they're assigned at birth or the binary, it becomes something that you know you have to think about. And what's nice about the current space we're living in is that, particularly with younger people, we're beginning to understand how important it is to allow people to kind of explore their gender identity before putting a bunch of pressure on them to conform one way or the other, or any way, really. So again, it's not perfect, and there's obviously decades and decades and decades of this institutionalized belief that it needs to be dismantled, but I think we're making a little bit of progress there. And trainings like this are one of the examples of how we're trying to impact that a little bit.
Absolutely. And you talk a little bit about exploring gender at an earlier age, and I think that's an important thing. A pediatrician friend of mine that is helped us put together this Healthcare Allies training talks about the fact that kids as young as age 3 may already have some sense of their gender. And it's not necessarily that they say, I'm a boy or I'm a girl. It's more about they just may have, if they're a boy, for example, they may have more female friends, or they may want to dress in their tutu more often and wear their mom's makeup and that sort of thing, or vice versa if they're a girl and they want to roughhouse with the boys next door mostly. But I think it's important to point out too that that's also perfectly normal activity for any child, right? And it's interesting because we get the opportunity to teach kindergartners occasionally, and when we do, we talk about boy toys and girl toys. And it's interesting to me that even by the young age of 5, you pull out a football and so many kids will say, that's a boy toy. And there are girls that say, no, I can play with that too. But especially going back the other direction, if you pull out a doll, there are very few boys that want to identify with that's something they play with. Already by the age, you know, by the time they start kindergarten, they have ideas that if I'm going to be a boy, I have to do the following things. And the thing about gender is, regardless of how you identify, it's perfectly acceptable for little kids, you know, for little boys to play with dolls, or for, you know, grown adult women to wear pants, whatever, that's kind of masculine, or cut their hair short, or that sort of thing. And we have these very strict kind of roles and expectations that we think people should fit into, whether they identify as a man or a woman. But even, you know, a person who identifies as transgender and say they're a trans man and they, you know, were born with a uterus, but they identify more as a male, and they, you know, they may still have some feminine tendencies from time to time, and that's okay. You don't have to be all of one or all of the other. None of us do. We all can kind of use gender however we want to.
I think that piece about the expectations assigned to the binary or certain genders is kind of the really powerful piece of that. I think, you know, it is telling that young people, young kindergartners, are able to distinguish between what genders can and should be doing what. Mm-hmm. That leads itself to disparities in a lot of ways, because when people feel like they aren't fulfilling the expectations that have been placed on them by society, it can lead folks to have a whole host of health issues, behavioral health concerns that are born out of this feeling of, why am I not normal, quote unquote. And so I think that expectation piece is pretty powerful. You know, when I used to work a lot with elementary school kids, I always thought it was fascinating when you're with kindergartners on the playground, you see like friends holding hands, right? Boys holding hands with the boys, girls holding hands with girls. By third grade, you don't really see that anymore, right? You see the girls that have these really, have the capacity to have these really close, intimate friendships that are born out of love. And then you see some of the boys, many of the boys actually, begin to not have those kinds of relationships with their peers. And that, you know, could be argued to leading to one of the biggest health disparities that we're learning about now or understanding, which is how men or male-identified folks, not everybody, obviously, this is not a thing, every man is like this, but we're seeing this kind of underdeveloped emotional intelligence that's leading to, you know, the perpetuation of violence, of self-harm, of harm to others. So that's also a disparity, mm-hmm. right? So born out of these expectations and the consequence they have, particularly on young people.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, I think the presentation that you choose for yourself and the actions that you do shouldn't really be defined by what your gender is and what you feel to be true. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't like to wear pants. I just don't ever want to wear pants if I can avoid it. My mom doesn't ever want to wear anything but pants. That doesn't affect what our gender identity is at all. It really doesn't matter. The actions that we choose for ourselves don't define that. It's our inner sense of who we are, which we don't choose. Like, you don't get to choose any of the identities that you just have, whether it's, you know, your race, your ethnicity, your sexual orientation, your gender identity. These are just things that are true about you, but you get to choose how you present them, what actions you do, and what words you choose, because those are things that you get to present to the world. That's who you get to be and who you get to choose to be, regardless of how you identify. But you also can choose not to follow what society says is the right way to do a thing. You can choose, you know, like, I have many students that get really upset because they feel like they're expected to go into a specific profession because of their gender identity. Like, I have a student that talked about how her parents are really want her to be a nurse instead of a doctor, but she wants to be a surgeon. So there's still, like, this really huge drive for these things that are difficult to push against. And when you're also adding in, like, not conforming to society in one way, it can be a little harder to push against those rules, too. So it's a whole messy mix of stuff that can make you feel really bad about who you are.
And I think one important thing to point out is gender affects everyone, whether we identify as cisgender, that is, as Sonia was saying earlier, you know, our assigned sex at birth matches who we know ourselves to be, or whether we're transgender or genderqueer or, you know, any of those other terms, it does affect us all. And it's okay, you know, to be cisgender. And as, you know, as a female, it would be okay if I really loved to bake and if my favorite thing in the world was to sing my baby to sleep, which is very true. And if I really wanted to wear makeup every day, which I don't, but, you know, if I wanted to be very feminine, that's okay. But if I was also a female that only wanted to be a little bit feminine or not very feminine at all, that's okay too, right? And gender is just one of those things that it has implications for all of us, I feel like. And on that topic, so both with gender and with sexual orientation, which we haven't had much time to talk about the difference, I think one thing that's important to say about both before we touch on how they're different is that it's not something that you see someone else and you say you are and assign a label to them, right? It's something, as Sonia said, that we see within ourselves and we are able to do. So if you're, you know, 4-year-old son does love to play with My Little Pony. I did have one little kindergartner who told me how much he loved My Little Ponies, and I was like, me too, buddy. Those are bronies. That's totally cool. But also, that doesn't mean that your child is transgender, right? That means that he's a little boy that likes to play with ponies. And give him time, he will figure out what his gender is, and it's not anything that has to be decided today or tomorrow or that a person needs to know at any point. It's just something that at some point they become aware of within inside themselves. So does one of you, maybe Christopher, want to talk about what the difference is between gender and sexual orientation?
Yeah, so like Sonia, I think, very eloquently described, gender has a couple components. You know, one could be someone's assigned sex at birth, which is, you know, a combination of their chromosomes, hormones, and genitals, parts of the body. Someone's gender identity is that insistent sense of who they are. Someone's gender expression is how you choose to express that gender identity or yourself to the outside world. So the way that you dress, the clothes that you wear, the things that you do in your spare time, all those things that kind of give people cues about you or things that you might be interested in. And then kind of complementing that, but a little bit separate from that, is someone's sexual orientation, which is really how we as humans are attracted or connected to others, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of stuff about gender is internal. It's about you as a person. People have their own sexual orientation as well, but it involves how they interact and how they feel about other people, either sexually, romantically, emotionally, intellectually. All those things can go into someone's sexual orientation. And people can have sexual orientations where they aren't, you know, sexually attracted to others, but they are romantically attracted to others, or maybe they are emotionally attracted to a certain kind of person or certain types of people, but they don't have the same sexual attraction to them. So all those things kind of go into how we interact with other folks. And just as with gender, everybody has a sexual orientation, and there are a lot of different types of sexual orientations, lots of combinations, lots of ways that we can engage with those throughout our lifetime with different types of people. And it is something that is personal, and something that, just like gender, cannot be assumed or inferred about somebody. And one of those really awesome things is that as humans we get to decide how, when, and if we share with others what our sexual orientation is. So they're connected because they're part of a person and they're part of us as beings, but they are different. Just know, if you're just breaking down the LGBT acronym that a lot of people use, the LG and B would be more descriptive of someone's sexual orientation, and the T, which in this case stands for transgender, would be more indicative of someone's gender identity. Mm-hmm. So they're connected, but separate.
And I really like how you reiterate, too, about how you can't make assumptions about it, because I was learning several months ago about something that what I was reading about was calling it bisexual erasure, which I found fascinating because it was very much the idea that if I'm bisexual, for example, and I'm dating a male, then people will assume I'm heterosexual. And if I stop dating that person and start dating a female, people will say, oh, you're a lesbian now. Like, no, there's still something else in between, so you can't make that assumption. And I think one thing that's important to point out and is also does affect people's health is how a person identifies and what actions they do may not always align, right? And so we've all heard about like experimenting in college, right? Straight people sometimes experiment. People who identify as gay sometimes experiment. And it's just, so even teasing out those different pieces of that may not always align with how someone identifies.
And I think just, that's another way to think about that too, is that many people can be attracted to other individuals for qualities that are separate from their gender, mm-hmm. right? So there could be quality in somebody that is, that someone finds attracting and intriguing, and I don't think that would necessarily mean, that wouldn't tell you anything about their sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. It just maybe says a little bit about how they're attracted to those individuals, right? So this idea that once somebody declares like, or is assumed even to say like, I am heterosexual, I'm straight, and anything that's other than that expected relationship is going to make you something different than heterosexual is, I think, a little bit what people think about and is a little bit problematic because, that's just not the case. And then that goes back to these expectations that if you're not meeting them can lead to poor health outcomes, poor relationships, whatever that might mean to that person.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the ways that you can like easily see that is I had a lot of friends talk about like what their type is, so the qualities that they're attracted to that really don't have a whole lot to do with gender. Mm-hmm. They'll be like, oh, I really like long hair, or I'm super into people that look like they could be from a comic book. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
these are words that we normally think that's a dude. Mm-hmm. that could be theoretically anybody. So it's the qualities too that might more frequently align with a specific gender but also might not, and I think it's hard too because it's so person to person based, and I think that people do have like an innate sexual orientation, like I definitely do.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, it's something that often shifts over people's lifetimes because you meet people and sometimes you realize something that you didn't before. Mm-hmm. I think that it's one of those things that can develop maybe a little later than your gender identity sometimes, because it's so dependent upon the other people that you're in relationships with or the other people that you're interested in or around.
Or that you're exposed to.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Well, and that's an excellent point. A straight person, as a straight woman, I'm not necessarily attracted to every man I've ever met. And, and just because I've never been attracted to a woman before doesn't mean at some point in my life I might be like, oh, wait, never mind.
Yeah.
You never know. So, yeah. One thing I wanted to ask about, Sonia, is you had mentioned that you use they and them pronouns.
Yes.
Whether you are at a doctor's office or just going through life, how do people know what your pronouns are, and why is it important that they use them correctly?
So for me personally, I do a lot of public work, so I've been called pretty horrible things a lot of the time. So to be honest, on a personal basis, people misusing my pronouns doesn't really get to me a ton. That said, it does get to a lot of the people that I'm around a lot because it's not an affirmation of who they are. So I like to use my pronouns as an opportunity for people to learn and practice without a fear of like deeply hurting my feelings, right? Which I think is important because it does take a lot of practice. I've messed up my own pronouns. Theoretically, that's not something you should be able to do, but language is so innate and so in us because we grew up with it, right? That it's really hard to get right sometimes because it's automatic. It's like snap and then oops, I messed up.
Mm-hmm.
So So for me, it's not a super, super like touchy thing. For a lot of people, it really is, because it is a part of who you are. It is how you identify, right? I'm not a she, I'm not a he, I'm a they. This is true, and I do feel that way. So for my classes, when I teach, I actually just tell them on the first day. It's in my email signature, which is actually a cool way to do it. You can just put it right under your name, right above where your title goes. It's where mine is. Or, you know, farther down if you're shyer is also fine. I also have a button that I sometimes wear with the pronouns on them. Like, that seems really obvious, but it's one of the things that I do when I'm doing events that have outreach a lot of the time. And I just tell people. I think the best way is, like, people can just ask me, how would you like to be referred to? And I just be like, oh, I use they, them pronouns. Also, you can use Sonia. I don't use my last name a bunch. right? So it's in the exact same way that I would ask, you know, a friend, hey, do you mind if I call you this when their name is like six syllables long,
yeah.
Right? So it works very similarly, I think, to nicknames in a lot of ways. And my students give me their pronouns when they give me their name that they want me to address them by in class. It's definitely a learning curve because it is hard, right? You need to like undo some of the language you've been trained in. And there's always gonna be slip ups. I mess up all the time. It's not good. It's something that I need to work on, but it's a little unavoidable because it is so completely a part of what we've been raised in, the water that we've been swimming in, so to speak.
You talk about other folks messing up. When someone messes up pronouns or says something that they realize as soon as it comes out of their mouth they should not have said, what responses have you heard that
it depends
are best?
So most of my friends and the people that know me well will go, oh, oops, sorry, I mean that, and then just move on. The best way to handle it is just to apologize, correct yourself, and move on. Making a big deal out of it isn't very productive and usually is like exhausting for the other person, because it's like, I don't really want to comfort you about you messing up my pronouns. It's a little messed up, right? But also, like, if a waitress were to mess up my name at my pronouns at a restaurant, it's not something that I'm going to take the time to care about, because I understand how language and assumptions work.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't know.
Yeah.
I use gender-neutral pronouns for everybody when I don't specifically know them because of this, or I try to as much as possible, so I just use they a lot. But there is like an issue with people that you just don't know that well. Like, I don't expect every single person at the coffee shop to know my pronouns, because that's not realistic.
Mm-hmm.
But people that are close to me, people like my bosses, when they mess up, it actually has an impact, because their job is in part to introduce me or to talk to me or to work with me. And it's important for people like that to know. And obviously the people I interact with day to day should know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of dependent on context a little bit too, but it is hard, and I think the best way to handle it is to just apologize and move on.
And I would say, like, on the flip side of that, the worst thing to do is to ignore it, and or not try and like learn from that mistake that was made, right? I know I see a lot of people sometimes who just have this thought process that they're just never gonna get what that person's pronouns are, and so they're just not going to try, or they're going to just keep there in their mind that each time they have an interaction, they're just going to, well, I'm just going to keep apologizing that I don't know, instead of trying to actually learn, understand, and commit that to their memory and how they know that person to be.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And this is part of our healthcare allies training, but I think it applies to everyday life as well. Are there certain questions that either of you want to share that you think are kind of like appropriate, or how does a person ask questions that they want to know? Like, for example, if Sonia, you mentioned you identify as genderqueer, correct? What if I don't know what genderqueer is, and I want to ask and I don't know? Is there a better way to go about that, or a worse way to go about that?
Depends on context.
Okay.
For much of the work I do, right, as a professional, it might not be incredibly important that my students know exactly what my personal definition for genderqueer is. That doesn't mean that if they approached me in their office hours, I wouldn't talk to them about it, but asking that in front of like a classroom setting wouldn't necessarily be appropriate, right? One-on-one conversations like, hey, I'm a little curious, what do you mean by this word? Is completely appropriate, right, in private.
Mm-hmm.
And be like, hey, I'm sorry, I know that it tends to mean this. Googling is a good trick. I know it tends to mean this, but what does it mean to you?
Okay.
Is kind of a good way of phrasing it, because my personal feelings about the word might be completely different than how Google defines it, right? Because definitions are imperfect, right? It'd be like looking up my own name in the dictionary. Like, it's probably not going to exactly align with how I feel about my name.
Well, I like that you mentioned that, because it's genderqueer, right? It has the word queer in it. And definitely when I was growing up, that was a negative word that was used to put someone down. And actually a kid in my class changed his name because his name was Greer and they called him queer. And he started going by his middle name because it was so harmful. And so for me, when I hear the word, I mean, I say it because I teach about it, and I know that queer tends to be the word that is used as the umbrella term for the LGBTQ community, but I also know that there are still folks out there that really don't like that word and would prefer that it not be used around them, and certainly not to refer to them.
So it is a reclaimed word, which always carries a lot of baggage with it, right? Because it carries a very specific history of oppression and of abuse and of problems, just broad problems. And so for me, part of why I like using it is because I like to carry that history with me, because it is a history that I don't think we're often told about and is often forgotten. And for me, it's one that is very important. And because I do activism work, it's a word that's very, very keyed into like political activism and political awareness in a way that a lot of other words aren't. So for me, it's not even just a gender identity or a sexual orientation identity. Because I also identify just as queer, as my sexual orientation. It's also kind of a political statement in a way, because it stands for a history and it stands for a movement. That doesn't mean that everybody that labels themselves as queer would feel the same way. This is why I choose to use it. A lot of the authors that I found a lot of solace in when I was learning about myself and trying to find a place to be accepted use that word to describe themselves, and so it has a very specific connotation to me. That definitely embraces its kind of muddy, messy, awful history.
But I think that the key thing there, too, is if somebody, that's not how everybody feels, right?
Right,
and so
yeah.
If somebody doesn't use the term queer to, if it's not affirming for them, then just because it's been reclaimed doesn't mean that we can assign that to them or, you know, just assume that they're going to be comfortable with that terminology, because they really get to decide what terms feel the most affirming for them. And we are at this point in our understanding of language and kind of that there are a lot of terms that we're beginning to know and accept and are becoming more understood. So that's kind of an exciting time too. And I'll just say that in the healthcare setting, which is where I spend most of my time, there are things that are important for providers to know that aren't important for everyone to know, right? So it might be more important for your healthcare provider, in fact it is, to know what sex you were assigned at birth. It might not be important for your colleagues to know that. It might not be important for your boss to know that, right? Mm-hmm. But there are certain medical considerations that could be impacted by that knowledge, right? And I think just for healthcare providers, one of the things that's really important is to share with patients, clients, where your gaps in knowledge are, right? Mm-hmm. So saying, you know, I'm going to ask you, I mean, if you're okay with it, we want to go through some of these questions that helps me understand you a little bit better and make a plan for your care in a way that's going to be best suited for you. There might be some things that we talk about that I don't know a lot about, so if you're okay with me asking them questions, that would be really helpful. If not, though, I'm happy to do my own research in advance of our next meeting, right? And it gives kind of opens the door, and when people hear that, generally, you want your doctor to know, to be able to be competent and understand you in a really holistic way. So if a provider approaches it like that, most people are willing to do some education because it's in their best interest, right? If a provider doesn't take the time to approach it in a way similar to that, it can come off as being very dismissive, or you can really lose confidence in your provider, which, you know, for a lot of people means that they probably won't go back to that care provider, and they might not go back to any care provider if they have negative experiences or experiences where they feel like they were not getting the best, most competent care. So that can have, you know, lifelong consequences. And just like every other, you know, marginalized or minority population, there is a lot of connectedness to the community. And so when one person's bad experience can translate to other people feeling like, well, maybe I'll have the same experience, so maybe I just won't go to do that, whatever that may be. In this case, healthcare. Maybe I won't go to the doctor. Maybe I won't tell my doctor that because I know two people who told their doctor that and they had this terrible response. Or this terrible reaction, or they left feeling worse than when they came in, which is like the exact opposite of what you want to do when you go to the doctor.
Absolutely.
So I think that the reality of pronouns comes into play there too, because pronouns are something that we all use all the time. It's not something that you can avoid using if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. It just is part of our language. And I think it is a really pretty simple and also powerful public display of acknowledging that somebody across from you is just as human as you are, and that you are seeing them and experiencing them for who they are. So I think that can be really powerful, especially in a healthcare setting, for the care provider to share their pronouns as they're comfortable with their patients, so the patients know how to most affirmingly refer to that person. And also, it's a good gateway to say, you know, my name is Christopher, I use he and him pronouns. I use those pronouns because they're the most, that's how I want to be referred to. Is there a way that you would like me to refer to you either in this conversation or as I'm writing, you know, up your notes about your visit, or as I'm talking about you to other members of the care team for your care coordination, whatever that might be, right? Can be really powerful, and you can learn a lot about somebody, and you can, you know, build a strong foundation with somebody just by using and making sure you're checking in about pronouns.
I mean, I think every time at the doctor, pronouns are definitely important. When you disclose other information or need to know other information is also important too, because like if you're a doctor working in the ER, you don't necessarily need to know anything beyond pronouns about the identity unless you're working with a specific part of the body, right? Mm-hmm. Like if someone comes in with a broken arm, their pronouns still matter, but the rest might not so much. So there's also a lot of context to it, right?
Definitely.
When I go to visit my normal doctor, my primary care doctor, for something like a pap smear, it is very important for my doctor to know a lot about my body and my identity and my sex assigned at birth, right? Because that procedure affects those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important for that, and obviously they should also know my pronouns. But when I go into the ER with, you know, a broken arm, that's a completely different context. And pronouns are still important because they're always important. That's the constant. But something like my specific
whether you
set
have a uterus
of organs
yeah.
is not necessarily as important because it's not affecting my arm a whole lot.
And I think that's a good takeaway for folks outside of the medical community as well, is just kind of asking respectful questions is important, and it's okay to ask questions, but you need to think about why. If it's just to satisfy your own curiosity, you may want to think about that. You know, it's a lot of folks that belong to the LGBTQ community are asked, things that aren't very...
at a charity ball not very long ago, I got asked what my genitalia looks like, yep. Which is not a question you should ask anybody. It's weird.
Yeah.
Basically
unless you
ever.
Plan on
yeah.
interacting with that genitalia. Nope.
Yeah.
Super creepy,
yeah.
Super weird. And that's an example of, like, is this doing something for a good reason or not? Like,
mm-hmm.
That's your own curiosity. That's when you Google.
Mm-hmm.
You have a phone that can do Google, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Google it.
I mean, and it is okay to be curious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but what's not the appropriate response is to ask people super personal questions, especially if you don't know them very well,
mm-hmm.
right? And you don't have that established relationship where there's this culture of trust and reciprocity and love even, you know, so.
Well, and one thing you can do is turn it around. So if you're wanting to ask somebody who identifies as lesbian, for example, well, I get this question a lot in high schools when I teach, which is, how does lesbian sex work? And I just think, if I turn it around in my head and make it about straight people, how does straight sex work? Would I ask a straight person then? No, then I probably shouldn't ask, how does lesbian sex work, right? Or if you're talking to somebody who's transgender, if it's not something you would ask someone who is cisgender, it's probably not something you're wanting to ask. So that's just kind of one quick way to
think
about it.
Do be careful when you Google these things, though, if you're curious, because there's not always great information, so look at your sources. This is a quick teacher moment. Look at your sources.
Yeah.
Porn websites are not a good way to learn things.
No, no.
And when I used to teach sex ed in high school, we get questions about, like, what you just shared, Cammie, about, like, how does this kind of sex work? I would take a moment of pause and be like, you know, this is very likely somebody who just is, you know, just curious and, you know, doesn't really know. And maybe they're just trying to make people laugh or giggle. But it is also just as likely that somebody who generally was never educated about the kind of sex that they either are engaging in or want to be engaging in, and they don't have any sort of information about that, you know, and no one's talking to them about it, no one's teaching them, like, how to have the kind of sex that they want to have and also protect themselves, or how to navigate conversations around those activities, right? So it's kind of hard because you don't know, when I hear those questions, I don't know exactly who this person is asking. I want to, you know, respond in all the ways possible, but in a classroom setting, you know, you only have an hour.
Yeah.
So it's challenging.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, in trainings and in medical fields, obviously, questions like that are a lot more warranted than, like, mm-hmm. on the street, mm-hmm. at a charity ball,
yeah,
in the classroom.
Yeah, definitely.
These are different contexts. So think about where you are and whether or not something's appropriate. If it's not a question you would ask your boss, probably don't ask it.
Oh, yeah. I like that. That's another good way to put it, if you wouldn't ask your boss.
Right.
Well, coming back to the healthcare side of things, I know there are certain things that people can do if they are anxious about disclosing their gender identity or sexual orientation to a healthcare provider. And we have some strategies to help folks be more comfortable doing that, or make sure that the place that they're going to be doing that at is an affirming place. So one thing that we recommend for folks who are part of the LGBTQ community or have a loved one that is and want to be going to the Access Healthcare with them is you can ask for referrals from friends. Like Christopher talked about, people not only talk about their negative experiences, but you can also talk to people who've maybe had positive experiences. Mm-hmm. And we here at BridgerCare did just put together a new list of resources in the area. And it's everything from healthcare providers to, physical healthcare providers to mental healthcare providers, hair removal, churches,
dentists.
Yes, I think there might be a dentist on the list. There's all kinds of different things. And the list wasn't created by calling these places and saying, will you see LGBTQ patients? The list was created by going to various groups in the area that are composed of this population and asking them, who have you seen that provided you with good care? So it's been vetted by that community. And if anyone is interested in having access to that list, we do have it on our website at bridgercare.org. But there's certainly more things that can be done before then. And Christopher, I honestly think most of the things on my list I got from talking to you a year or so ago. So do you want to talk through some of the other things that folks can do to access affirming healthcare?
Yeah, I think like what you shared is great for, like, finding a doctor, right? Knowing who you can go to, who you can trust based on people's experiences. I think also for some folks who maybe don't access healthcare as frequently, arriving a little bit early is a good strategy too. When you're making an appointment, calling and making sure, like, what am I going to bring with me? I think writing down your questions you might have for your provider is also crucial. And sometimes I think people can even hand those to their provider when they get into, like, the room. So that provider knows, like, oh, this is what the person is going to talk about or wants to know about. And it kind of gives that person some cues about what other things might be impacting those questions. I think being clear with the provider if they haven't answered your questions in a way that the way that I know doctors and other care providers is that they do want to answer your questions. They are in this profession, they are in this work, they are coming to work every day because they want to help folks solve or address health concerns. And so if they feel like they're not answering your questions and you tell them that, they do want to help you, right? So that's why they get into this profession. I think that it's also kind of powerful if you're nervous about going to a medical center, bringing someone who you know and trust with you. It doesn't mean they have to be in the room with you, just actually to come to the space, and who can be, like, your ally and advocate for as you maybe navigate some forms that aren't super affirming or are going to talk about something that you're maybe not as comfortable talking about. So I think just making yourself as comfortable as you can in that space and really making sure that the questions that you want are addressed, and you can do that by writing them down and giving them in advance to the provider. It can be pretty powerful.
Those are generally pretty good tips, I think, for anybody.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Too. Like,
yeah.
These work for anybody,
yeah,
if you're uncomfortable going to the doctor, because I know a lot of people that don't identify in the LGBTQ+ community that are still like, oh, God.
Yeah.
No doctor. Absolutely.
Yeah, 100%.
Well, we only have about 3 minutes left, but before we go, I wanted to ask, is there any one thing about the Healthcare Allies training that we're doing, or just in general, that you want folks to know about the LGBTQ population or anything like that?
I will say, as someone who works in public health and healthcare, that even folks who are feeling like they are pretty confident around LGBTQ identities and affirming care, continuing education is usually a good idea, because things evolve and change, and there's new information, there is opportunities for growth, and to go above and beyond what just like the standard of care is, to really excellent, affirming, patient-centered, high-value, informed healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so continuing education about LGBTQ folks, but also all folks, is just important. And it's exciting that in a lot of our communities, trainings are being made available to address specifically LGBTQ folks and the disparities, the unique disparities that impact them. So I think just take advantage of trainings.
Yeah. I think another cool resource for that, and we use these in many of the trainings that I do, not just the Healthcare Allies one, but also Safe Zone, are the Harvard Implicit Bias Tests, which are about a lot of different marginalized groups. And those are, if you want to try to be more inclusive or more affirming, and you know that you have like certain tendencies that aren't conscious most of the time, they're accidental, that's a really great way to learn a little bit more, so then you can kind of nip it a little in the bud, learn. Because it's not necessarily your fault, it's because this is the culture that we're in, and sometimes you have to overcome it in order to be inclusive and affirming. I think this is true for everybody, healthcare providers too, and wanting to learn, taking the actions to learn is super, super important, right? Having the drive for the education and to want to be inclusive to everybody around you is something that I think we should all really strive for.
And I guess just to add on to that, the only two things, well, not the only, two of the things that I think are most important about the training that we do that I really want folks to take away is, if you know one patient who identifies a certain way, you only know one patient. Does that make sense? You can't make assumptions. And so in our training, we talk about the healthcare disparities, but you can't just assume that every gay man who walks through your door is there to get an HIV test or that they need one today. They might be there for another reason. You can't assume that every trans kid who comes through your door has an eating disorder, right? They have a higher likelihood of eating disorders, but that does not mean that they're, if they're having stomach issues, that it's because, you know, they have one. And so that not making the assumptions, I think, is very important to me. And the other one that I think is super important to point out, because we talk a lot about health disparities and other disparities facing the LGBTQ+ population, but I think one other thing to keep in mind is it's not always a negative experience, right? So for a lot of folks, their sexual orientation and their gender identity is very empowering to them, and being able to come out and live as their true selves can help them grow and expand in different ways. And yes, they are at higher risk for various mental health disorders, but that doesn't mean that every person who identifies as transgender, for example, will have a mental health disorder. And what we see is, especially for youth, when their parents are affirming, they have depression and anxiety rates similar to cisgender kids. It's just that societal and cultural stuff that gets added on that can cause them the added distress. So unfortunately, we are absolutely out of time today, but thank you so much, Christopher and Sonia, for joining us.
Thank you.
And you have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, you too.